Oh, so hi everybody. It's a pleasure to let you know what I've been doing, at least part of what I've been doing since I came here. That's almost 2 years ago, and it's been a work done in collaboration with these two folks, Emanuele and Sina. And it's about basically figuring out what's happening inside a black hole. Well, I mean, as I will explain. We start to consider like foliation, which is horizon penetrating, but then like we end up with a very messy equation. So we restrict to the interior to solve the equation, which becomes much simpler. And basically, what I'm going to present today is first the construction of the full equation, but then the prediction that only the restriction to the interior leads to. So, but let me start first with the semi-classical picture of black hole evaporation. So this, in the standard story, basically, as you might know very well, you have that at the end of the evaporation, when the horizon shrinks to zero area, basically a state which was initially pure on sigma 1, it's now a mixed state on sigma 2, in the sense that some of the information of the pure state has ended up inside the horizon, and it's basically it's lost. So we cannot really describe the final state in terms of a pure state anymore. And basically, this is helps with the S-matrix description of quantum field theory. So in order to rescue the S-matrix picture, what people have been proposing, for instance, is this scenario of complementarity, which basically you have to have some modification of the physics at the horizon in order to imprint the information or info in matter first on the horizon, then eventually from the horizon to the on the outgoing Hawking radiation. And the reason why you need new physics is because if you take the classic the semi-classical picture of quantum field theory on the background, on the curved background, that tells you that for an fully observer, the vacuum at the horizon, the state of the field at the horizon is a vacuum state. Which means that basically, when you have two quanta created by the interaction of test field with the background, A and B, they have to be maximally entangled in order to have a vacuum state. But then, if you require basically, if you want the final state to be pure, namely to recover information of what fell inside black hole, you need correlation between late and early Hawking quanta, which of course, it's not allowed if you have already maximally entangled state between A and B, unless you violate the equivalence principle, in the sense that basically the state at the horizon is no longer vacuum, and so you have like a violation of the equivalence principle on scales where you don't expect this to happen. So in a way to avoid this inconsistency claim is basically to have instead some decoherence with cheap energy, cheap hidden degrees of freedom. And the proposal for concrete proposal for this case is the remnant scenario, for instance, in which basically what happens is that at the end of the evaporation, when quantum gravity effects become strong, you can have basically the semi-classical picture doesn't apply anymore. So you can have that the evaporation stops when before reaching a zero area and it forms a remnant. So basically, in this dark region here, that's when quantum effects becomes relevant. What you form is this remnant, which has the mass of a Planck mass, people expect, and a radius of a Planck length. So basically, for an observer now in sigma 2, what happens is that it would cross this time-like tube of the remnant at some point, and you would see basically this remnant as a point particle for this observer. And then the entanglement basically would be between the degrees of freedom of the Hawking radiation outside that has been emitted and some cheap energy degrees of freedom which are inside the remnant. Now, of course, since you need a lot of degrees of freedom to recover the full information, which this means that there must be a lot of this should be a huge degeneracy inside the remnant, and people have been claiming that this can have could lead to basically massive production of this of these states, which people should see in the lab, but we don't see in the lab. So this is some a criticism that people move towards the remnant. I don't think it's really founded, since you cannot really treat remnant as a point particle. But I don't want to get into the details of this aspect here. I just want to mention that there is somehow a revised story of the remnant, which takes the form of black hole tunneling into a white hole. has been proposed by these people, for instance, but basically the idea is the same. Instead that basically now the difference is that you see the remnant as a tunneling process between from a black hole turning into a white hole, which for an observer outside takes a very long time, and in particular it could take as long as the evaporation time of the black hole through Hawking radiation. So this process basically can be interpreted as a very long remnant forming from this tunneling process. And information, again, would be between the degrees of freedom inside that fell inside, which are inside the white hole in a sense, that will eventually come out, but only at the very end of the evaporation process. So only at the very end you will have that degrees of freedom can come out. So, however, I want to mention also another example of what could happen, which maybe is not so, you know, may not be so familiar with, which is this idea which goes back all the way to the 88 by these people here. And basically what they were suggesting was a possibility that when you fall inside a black hole and quantum gravity effects become become relevant, then if you have like a maximum, if you have a bound on the curvature inside, then what you can do is to glue the Schwarzschild geometry inside to a geometry of a closed de Sitter universe on the other side. So this would be like a space-like region where the curvature reaches its maximum value. And then after this, basically, you can glue the geometry to a de Sitter universe. And what you can have is, for instance, that there is so there would be a phase of deflation of the closed seat, and then you have an inflation again. So you will have like an expanding universe inside the black hole, or inside the black hole horizon. Of course, then this could be a baby universe in the sense that there could be a topology change if the horizon for the outside observer of the event horizon disappears completely, or it could be a remnant if the evaporation process stops again at a certain finite value of the radius. But this doesn't really matter in the sense that what I just want to point out is that there has been this picture proposed now like so many years ago, and this will become relevant towards the end of my talk. So that's why I wanted to mention it. Now, my point is, in general, if you want to have some conservative solution to the information loss paradox problem, you need to have removed singularities. The black hole's central singularity needs to be removed. And only a full quantum gravity calculation can really tell you which scenario actually happens, if it's a remnant, if it's a white hole, if you have a baby universe, what happens. Now, we have a proposal for the theory of quantum gravity, which goes under the name of loop quantum gravity, and we should use it to investigate what happens to a black hole singularity. However, there is a crucial caveat in the story, which is what comes first, reduction or quantization? What I mean is, a black hole is a system with some symmetry, and as is well known, like using symmetry can simplify equation motion a lot. So what should we first do the symmetry reduction, then quantize the reduced phase space, or should we instead quantize the full theory and then perform the symmetry reduction at quantum level? These two processes do not commute in general, and actually they lead to quite different pictures, as I'm going to argue. Now, what has been done mainly in the literature so far is to follow the first path, which is to do a symmetry reduction first. So you start with JR parameterized by connection variables. You perform a symmetry reduction and you go to a mini superspace, which you, on each the phase space is labeled by finite number of degrees of freedom, and then you use some LQG derived quantization techniques to quantize this reduced phase space. This is basically what leads to this picture of a polymer black holes, in which you use point holonomies instead of holonomies defined on extended one dimensional surfaces, and which eventually leads to the loss of degrees of freedom associated to the graph structure. So what you do, following this path, you are freezing from the beginning many degrees of freedom, which you don't know if they're relevant or not. Now, the alternative would be instead to quantize the full phase space, a la loop quantum gravity, and then come up with a procedure of symmetry reduction on the quantum level. In this way, you don't have to freeze some degrees of freedom, but what you can do is to integrate them out to end up again eventually with some reduced phase space effective description, which still, and which however, capture now all the degrees of freedom present, at least the relevant degrees of freedom present in the full theory. In particular, you don't lose information about the graph structure. So I'm going to now describe how this second path can be realized in practice within the context of quantum gravity. This goes under, this program has been dubbed quantum reduced loop gravity. And basically, it's a process that can be implemented, a procedure can be made in four steps. But before getting to these four steps, let me just give you an overview of how you can deal with symmetry reduction in a classical case. And usually, you have three possibilities, basically, when you want to perform a symmetry reduction. First of all, the symmetry reduction can happen in two steps. The first step is to do a partial gauge fixing of the metric, which you're not imposing any symmetry yet. You just partially get fixing your phase space. And best, usually, what, the way to do this is to impose, to introduce gauge fixing condition, which basically turn the system into a second class system. So the way to deal with second class system is to either solve the second class constraints, if you're able to, B, to use the Dirac bracket to implement basically the remaining first class constraint, in which the, you basically you throw the second class constraint inside the Dirac bracket. Or there is a less known approach, which it's called gauge unfixing, which basically allow you to use the ordinary Poisson brackets for the non-gauge fixed variables at the cost of modifying the constraint which now you want to impose. So this is somehow a procedure which comes in between. And it's going to be useful for quantization because usually the problem with quantization, I'm going to get to this in a second. And then, OK, the second step would be then to implement the symmetry reduction once you have performed this gauge fixing on the reduced phase space. So for the quantization, then you can either quantize the classically reduced phase space with or without symmetry, or quantize the Dirac brackets. If you in the first two examples. And quantization Dirac bracket is oftentimes a very complicated process. That's why the gauge unfixing provides an alternative to this, which it's easier to deal with at the quantum level. And the steps that I was mentioning before basically are these ones. You want to impose the second class constraint weakly on the full Hilbert space, so that this basically gives you a reduced Hilbert space, which is the analog, is the quantum analog of the reduced phase space. And then you want to project the constraint that you have defined in the full theory to represent the analog of the classically gauge unfixed constraint. So basically, by projecting down the constraint, what you will have are the quantum version of the reduced constraint plus these modifications that you need in order to preserve the gauge fixing. Then you can impose the symmetry by means of coherent states. You can build coherent states which encode the information of the symmetry and obtain an effective dynamic by evaluating expectation values of this reduced constraint on these coherent states. In this way, you end up again with an effective description which lives in the mini superspace, but which now contains information about the full theory. So then the starting point for this program is to find a quantum symmetry reduction which is compatible with a given metric, of course. In the case of the black hole, there is an obvious choice, which is the orthogonal gauge fixing, which I'm going to describe in a moment. But if you have questions about this procedure, please ask me now.
So first, when you say to impose the constraints, those are the GR constraints, and then
yes.
You reduce the symmetry to the being isotropic or something?
The symmetry, you impose it by constructing coherent states which contain information of a classical geometry you want to pick around.
Mm-hmm.
So it contains information about the symmetry. This comes after. The reduction of the constraint is something that you can do regardless of the symmetry. It's just basically you're getting rid of some components of fluxes and connections. Okay, so let's start with the reduced phase space first to explain what the symmetry reduction that eventually the partial gauge fixing that eventually I want to implement in the quantum theory is. So if we start with a reduced phase space for a spherical symmetry, which is compatible with spherical symmetry, basically you can parameterize the intrinsic metric in terms of two phase space functions, lambda and r, which are function a priori of both variable, time variable, and this radial coordinate r. And then if you go to the from the DM phase space to the connection formulation, you can parameterize the connection and the fluxes in this way, where basically you have three components for the connection and three conjugate momenta, which are three components for the fluxes with these standard Poisson brackets here. Now, the gauge fixing that I want to implement is basically, it's listed here. I want to kill two internal components of the ER part of the flux and one internal component of the angular components of the flux. So basically, I want a triad which is, in a sense, block diagonal. It has only ER3 non-vanishing, and for the angular part, only the internal components 1 and 2 non-vanishing. This is the gauge fixing that I want to implement. Now, the way to do this now in the quantum level is first step to build the reduced kinematic Hilbert space. So we start with the Fourier QG Hilbert space parameterized, which carries a representation of holonomies and flux. And then the first step is to reduce the choices of graph that you can have, because the Hilbert space is labeled by graphs. And in order to, a crucial element to do the reduction is to select only specific graph. And in this case, basically what you want to do, you want to like adapt your graph to the coordinate system that you're using. In this case, basically, what you have at each point are three directions. There's a radial direction and two angular directions on the two sphere. So you can, what you want to use is a graph, what you can use is a graph which has a cuboidal structure, which at each vertex you have three directions. Like for instance, there is this plaquette here is a plaquette that lies on the two sphere. And so you have the theta and phi directions. And then like if you go in the radial direction, you move in this way and you have the other plaquettes. So this is the kind of graph that you want to use. And then to each links of this graph, you assign basically these group elements in the representations that are aligned with the direction that you choose. So what you do is to choose some, align some internal direction with tangent directions. For instance, the three internal direction of the SU2 group with the R tangent direction, the radial tangent direction. And then what you do is on the links which are in the R direction, you associate basically a group element in a representation which diagonalize the JZ, and it's actually picked on JZ. So the way to pick it is to basically select the magnetic numbers which only either the maximum or the minimum. In general, the magnetic numbers can go from minus J to plus J, and if you appear, you have to sum up all the possibilities. But if you pick only on the maximum, the minimum, basically you are selecting a state which diagonalize JZ, and basically is zero on the other two directions, the other two spins. And you can do the same for the other for JZ and JY. So in the other two directions, on the tangent plane, on the two sphere, for instance, you choose Wigner elements that are aligned to the direction that you want to have, the internal direction that you have. This is done by using these coherent states, these SU2 coherent states that select basically this, impose this restriction on the representations that you allow you to impose the restriction on the representation that you allow. Now, why this choice basically implement the gauge fixing that I was mentioning is because now if you look at fluxes discretized on faces which are dual to this graph, cuboidal graph, then you can see that in expectation value, those components that you wanted to kill classically have zero expectation value on these states. And this is what this is achieved by choosing this restriction on the representation matrices, basically. That's the trick. Then you can construct free valent vertices using, this is a graphic notation for what I was telling you. Basically, this symbol here means peaking on the maximum or the minimum magnetic numbers, and these are the U's that bring the Z direction into the internal, on the tangent direction that you want to, along which you want to peak your state. And you can define reduced flux operators by basically introducing these projectors for the flux. And then these are the reduced fluxes which define the reduced operators in your Hilbert space, the reduced geometrical operators in your Hilbert space. In this way, you can basically, so the reason why you want to do this is because now you can work with the complete structure of the theory, but at the same time, you, by using this restriction, you have a simplification when it comes to evaluating action of operators on the Hilbert space. In particular, you can see that now all the geometric operators you can build out of the E's or the fluxes become diagonal on these states. And this is a very useful simplification for a reason that I'm going to tell you immediately, which is now when you want to quantize the Euclidean, the Hamiltonian constraint, both the Euclidean and the Lorentzian pieces, what you have to do is basically you have to put hats on the reduced expressions, for instance, and this means to replace these classical quantities with the reduced operators, the analog in the reduced phase space. And now you see that if you use, for instance, Tiemann's techniques to quantize the Euclidean Hamiltonian constraint, usually the difficulty is that you have this volume operator here, which was actually highly non-trivial. In fact, in particular, it's very hard to diagonalize this, this object. But now this becomes orthogonal immediately. So you can compute immediately the action of this guy on this reduced Hilbert space. And what you need in order to compute this action is also to have a representation of the Lonomy operators. And for this, you need a recoupling rule. And again, you need to introduce a reduced recoupling rule, which basically preserves these restrictions that you have on the representation. So these are just some technical aspects of the construction, point being that you can now compute the action of this Hamiltonian constraint, both the Lorentzian and the Euclidean, in a very straightforward manner. And then what you can do, the first step is to build these coherent states to implement the symmetry. So the way to do it is, to use these coherent semiclassical states introduced by these people, which rely on this on the use of this heat kernel for SU2, which then you basically you do an any continuation from SU2 to SL2C. And the idea is simply that basically you can define states which are Gaussians picked on both the intrinsic geometry, which is chosen by this classical expression for the fluxes, and an extrinsic curvature, which is encoded in this classical expression for the SU2 group elements, which are basically the holonomies of the Ashiga-Barbero connection. So this SL2C group element here is the one that tells you around which geometry you want to pick. It tells you which extrinsic and intrinsic geometry you want to pick around. In particular, you can see that these states here are become Gaussians around the semiclassical values of the fluxes, which I give you here. These pins peak around these values, which are expressed in terms of the classical fluxes components. Of course, then if you specify who these guys are, that tells which geometry you are picking around. So that's the whole. That's how you implement the symmetry in this in this picture. And now the last step is to basically compute. Of course, then you want to build this guy. On your graph, you want to glue them together with the intertwiner piece as well. So this is the weight function, the full weight function for the cube. You have like one of this Gaussian for each link, and then you have some intertwiner piece of the weight function. But this is really not important. Don't worry about this stuff. It's just to tell you that basically you can now compute immediately the action of the Hamiltonian constraint on this state weight by this weight, which is the one is a Gaussian weight around the classical geometry. So you compute the action on the graph on the state I was telling you before, which is this reduced spin network here, and this Gaussian weight tells you that the expectation value is evaluated on a geometry picked around the classical geometry, and that's how you recover a semi-classical expression, an effective expression for your Hamiltonian constraint. And if you do it, that's what you get, basically. So these are the three pieces. There is the Euclidean, the reduced Euclidean operator. Then there is this extension I was mentioning before that you need in order for the new constraint to preserve the gauge fixing. So, and only the Euclidean part gets an extension. And then there's the Lorentzian term, which does not get an extension because it doesn't contain variable outside of the reduced phase space. Anyway, this is the final expression here. So you and it's hard to believe in, but if you take the leading order of this guy, leading order in terms of this epsilon, the epsilons are the parameters that determine basically the quantum corrections. These are the coordinate length of your graph. And to take the classical limit, what you have to do is to do an expansion of this epsilon and then basically integrate over the variables that you have, the coordinates that you have to recover the expression of the Hamiltonian constraint. So you basically what you do, you replace the integral with the sum, and the sum is the sum of the plaquettes, and these epsilons are the length, the coordinate length of these plaquettes. So if you do this expansion in epsilon, in the leading order, that would give you the reduced Hamiltonian constraint for a spherical symmetric geometry. Now, the question is what to do with this thing? Well, as I was saying, this is the result that you get when you choose a foliation which is horizon penetrating. Here I haven't specified yet which kind of foliation to choose, so I'm considering generic foliation with a shift different from zero. Now, if you restrict to only the interior, in which you have basically you have an homogeneous foliation available, then things become much simpler. So let me now tell you how to solve that. This monster here in the case in which you restrict to the interior solution only. So when you go into the interior, basically what happens is that you have in the Schwarzschild foliation, the Cauchy slices have this topology R cross S2 and they become homogeneous. You see, like because what was this R now is a space like it's a time-like coordinate, which I call tau. So what was before R now is tau and is time-like. And what before was T is now X, which is space-like. So the intrinsic metric does not depend on the coordinate, the spatial coordinate anymore. The foliation is homogeneous. And so basically we're looking, if you look at the Penrose diagram on Schwarzschild, we're looking at this region here. And we choose this lapse because eventually provides a useful parameterization of time. With this lapse, basically what happens is that tau equals zero is the horizon location, and then tau negative is the interior, and the singularity corresponds to tau going to minus infinity. So this this is and the space-like surface here as this topology, as I was saying, is a cylinder. X as a, you introduce a cutoff for X because a priori X goes all the way to infinity. In order to regularize certain integral, you have to introduce a cutoff, but nothing really depends on the cutoff when you look at the equation of motion, so don't worry about this cutoff. I just mentioned it because it's using the reduced phase space quantization approach. And then you can go back to ADM variables. So these are the phase space in terms of connection fluxes parameterized now by only two. Degrees of freedom, E1, ER, which are the conjugate moment of A1 and AR, and you can go back to the DM variable, this lambda and R, and so you have a phase space which has these two conjugate variables. And now you see the effect Hamiltonian that I wrote before takes this very simple form. So here I want to, now I want to comment about two aspects of this Hamiltonian. This looks similar to the Hamiltonian that people derived by using polymer quantization techniques to quantize the reduced phase space. So this is what I was mentioning at the beginning. If you follow the first route that you reduce first and then you quantize using polymer quantization techniques, what you get is an Hamiltonian which looks similar to this, except there is a crucial difference that you don't get this object here, which is this Struve function, but you get a sinus. So it basically, you get this, if you replace this H0 with this sign here, you will recover the reduced phase space quantization Hamiltonian. And also you have to take only the leading order of this object here. So if you take only the leading log, the epsilon squared piece of this part, and you replace H0 with sign, you get the LQC analog of the Hamiltonian. Now, this H0 is crucial in the sense that it has very important implications for the effective dynamics. In particular, It's what prevents you from obtaining a white horizon for the interior geometry. So you see that, and this is, really comes from the graph on the two sphere that you throw away in the point holonomy's quantization technique, and here you have included in the construction. So all the degrees of freedom that were thrown away have in fact a very important role, and it gives you this different physical picture. The second aspect I want to emphasize is the role of this quantum parameters epsilon. Because you see that now the Hamiltonian depends on these parameters, epsilon, epsilon x. So I only have one epsilon for the tangential direction of the two sphere. So I basically I assume epsilon theta and epsilon phi to be the same, and then I have epsilon x in the radial direction, which here it's still r, but r, as I was saying, is become time-like inside. So x is the space-like direction in the radial orthogonal to the two spheres. That's why I call it epsilon x, but would be in this case it would be this direction here. And the dynamics depend, the solution, the dynamics depend also crucially on the form of these parameters. So you need to have arguments to basically all the literature of the polymer quantization technique has been about choosing different expressions for these parameters and playing around with that. So the mu naught, the mu bar scheme, I don't know if you're familiar with the LQC literature, but this is all, that's basically what people have been doing for 15 years. Now here, there is a very clear way to somehow to constrain further these parameters, which is to use the graph structure, the discretized structure that you use, introduce, and basically what you do is to say, okay, I want to the area of a certain two sphere to be, is, you know, that is given by basically you assume that all there is like an average spin for the dual spin J0, and you say, okay, the area of the two spheres to be equal to the sum of all the area of all the plaquettes that form two sphere, and similar, you can do the same argument, you can use the same argument for the volume, and by using these global geometrical considerations, what you end up with is this expression for the epsilon, where there is a alpha and beta are two constant, which depend on these two spin J0 and J. So J0 is the average spin in the, dual to the two sphere, and J is the average spin tangent to the two sphere. So the links along theta and phi basically carry spin J, and the links along X carry spin J0. And these are the two quantum numbers that basically determine the expression for these quantum parameters. And notice that the parameters depend on the phase space variable R and lambda. So they contribute to the dynamics. Now, I want to restrict further this dependence on the quantum numbers. And to do that, I want to use an argument which relies on the simplicity constraint. The argument is the following. If I was outside those as I was mentioning before, x inside is a space-like direction, but if I go outside, x becomes a time-like direction. If I want to have an homogeneous foliation outside and compare with what I'm using inside, then this is the relation. In J, inside is the expectation value of a generator of rotations in these planes, x theta and x phi, and J0, as I was mentioning, is the expectation value of the rotation in the other plane, theta phi. Now, so this form an internal S2 group. If you go outside, now J becomes the expectation value of a generator of boosts in the planes T phi and T theta, while J0 stays the same. So from the outside point of view, now I can have, if I want to impose the simplicity constraint, namely that the expectation value of the boost should be equal to gamma, the expectation value of the rotations, then this gives me this restriction between the two spins, J equal gamma J0. So now by basically sort of continuity relation with the discretization that I would use outside to the inside, I impose the same restriction on my on the spins also in the inside. So if you want, you can see this restriction as some continuity condition that you would have if you use an homogeneous foliation outside and homogeneous foliation inside. And this is the interplay that, between canonical covariant theory, which has been applied in the past as well, and actually in the context of black hole physics, and turns out to be important to prove, for instance, the thermality properties of the horizon. So now we can look at the effective equations that we get from that Hamiltonian. What we have to solve are the Hamiltonian evolution equations generated by that Hamiltonian with a given choice of laps and with that choice of quantum parameters that I was showing you before. I only show you the evolution equations for R and lambda, but of course there are two more. There is also the one for PR, the momentum conjugate to R, and the evolution equation for the momentum conjugate to lambda. But I want to show you these two because basically what I want to solve now for is I want to find a solution such that R dot over R is equal to lambda dot over lambda. What I mean is that basically I want to look for solution such that when I go to tau minus infinity, so when I go as small times far away from when I go towards the what would be the classical singularity, basically I have this relation here for the expansion of R and lambda, which is an exponential expansion with the Hubble parameter given by basically this a constant C divided by 2m, the mass of the black hole. And you can make an ansatz for how this phase space function should behave. And what you end up with once you plug in this ansatz on these two equation motion plus the other two I didn't show you is basically these two restrictions. These are two functions, two equations for these two constants, sigma alpha and sigma beta, which determine basically how the phase space functions behave. And if you solve these two equations, you end up with this expression. You see this constant here that gives you the rate of expansion of R and lambda, takes this numerical value, and half over beta has this ratio. So let me clarify that the solution, the qualitative behavior of the solutions only depends on the ratio between alpha and beta, where alpha and beta, let me remind you, are this constant that enter the expression of the quantum parameters. So it's only the ratio between alpha and beta that determines what the solution really does asymptotically, not the single values. And this is the ratio that you get between alpha and beta. Now, if you plug, let me show you what the solution, if you solve numerically, what you obtain. So if you solve numerically, basically you, what you get, this is the solution for R. So red is the classical solution. It starts decreasing and eventually goes to zero asymptotically as tau goes to minus infinity. What happens in the effective solution is that at some point it bounces and then it starts growing exponentially as I was telling you before. So this was the ansatz I was taking. And you see if tau is negative, when you solve this differential equation, basically you get an exponential expansion for negative tau for R and lambda. And the bouncing time, so this is a consider a black hole of a mass of 10 to the 12 Planck mass. The bouncing time is basically around the value of the time at which the Creshmann scalar becomes Planckian. So that's when exactly when you expect quantum gravity correction to become relevant, namely when the curvature becomes Planckian, which does not happen. Sometimes you think this happens when the R becomes or the order of Planck length. It's not true. The curvature becomes Planckian much before. In fact, it becomes Planckian when the radius of the radial coordinate goes to the cubic root of the mass, so way before you reach the Planck length. And in this coordinate time is this tau star, the value for which the curvature becomes Planckian. And in this case, it's more or less 10 times, minus 10 times the mass of the black hole. And you see that the bounce happens basically around that instant of time. And lambda also, so what lambda does classically is zero at the horizon, and then it starts growing, and then eventually explodes, it diverges at the singularity. What it does here is that around the same time where you have the bounce, you have this exponential increase. So like it explodes much faster than a classical solution. And you might worry that this leads to a singularity in the curvature, but actually this is not the case because this is balanced best by this expansion, this growth of R, and also the other two phase space variables have a different behavior from the classical one. So what you can check is that the, for instance, the Creshmann scalar is always bounded, and it has a bound, so it has a peak around the bounds time, and it's, the bound is mass independent. So if you increase the mass, this is very small mass. The solid black hole has 10 to the 38 Planck mass. So this is already, for a very small black hole, this effective dynamic give you a singularity resolution. And you have a peak, a bound, which is mass independent. And also you can check that there are no large quantum effects. What I mean by large quantum effects are that you don't see quantum effects in a region where you don't expect it, namely when you have a low curvature region, for instance, at the horizon or near the horizon. And to check that, basically you can plot the value of the effective Creshmann scalar with the classical one, and you see that it's one all the way until you reach, in this case, I'm parameterized by rho. Rho equal one is basically is when the radius r is the r at tau critical. So when you enter the quantum regime, quantum gravity regime, rho is equal to one, and you see that you start deviating from this ratio deviates from one only when you enter this quantum gravity regime. So there are no large quantum effects. But what's maybe more interesting is what that ratio of alpha and beta that leads to a de Sitter solution corresponds to. If you plug in, as I was saying, this relation between J and J0 given by the simplicity constraint, then the ratio between alpha and beta can be expressed as a ratio between J and J0, which now is just gamma. And this gives you a value of gamma, which is the Mirsky parameter, which if takes this number here. Now, what is this number? For most of you, this might mean nothing, but actually, I spent half of my PhD chasing after this number, and the rest of it trying to move away to get rid of this number. I was successful in the first part to get this number, but I was not quite successful at all to get rid of this number. And now, it comes back again. So this number is basically the same value of the Mirsky parameter that you need to fix to get exactly the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy expression from LQG. So you might have heard that in LQG, you can recover the black hole entropy calculation, like the 1 over 4 of the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, at the price of fixing this Mirsky parameter. And this has always been considered somehow an Achilles heel of the calculation LQG. And people always say, but you should not, I mean, the entropy calculation is a semi-classical calculation, which should not depend on the Mirsky parameter because the Mirsky parameter has no implication for the classical gravity theory. So if you really, if this value really has some physical relevance, it should come from a completely different calculation, which tells you that you should fix gamma to this value here. And this is what's happening now. You have a completely different calculation, of course, in the context of black hole, which leads to the same value. So let me tell you what the geometry is like asymptotically, to go back to this picture of Mukhanov and collaborator of the Sitter space-time. So what you get is this asymptotic metric, which is not quite the Sitter. It becomes the Sitter when you go to tau to minus infinity, in the sense that you can see that basically Riemann, the Ricci tensor takes this form as proportional to g mu nu with a constant lambda, which now is given by the mass of the black hole and the Planck length. So there is basically an effective cosmological constant that emerges in this picture, which is a function of the black hole mass that you fell inside and the Planck length. So there's a quantum gravity origin for this cosmological constant. And the picture then, the Perron's diagram, it's quite different. It's a bit different than the one I was showing you before in the sense that you don't have this closed, this is a flat De Sitter space asymptotically, it's not closed. So you don't have this extra box up here. What you have is basically you fall inside, you follow the classical trajectory until you reach this tau critical, then you bounce, and asymptotically, basically what you achieve then is, this would be like a strip of the Poincaré patch of the Sitter. So asymptotically, you get this, you get this cry, which is now space-like, And you have like a strip of the Poincaré patch of the sitter, asymptotically. So this is the Penrose diagram, more or less, of what of the geometry that you have. So you fall inside, you bounce, and you end up in a asymptotic de Sitter spacetime with an effective cosmological constant given by the black hole mass. So let me conclude. We'll see, I'm trying to argue that it's crucial that you keep into account all the relative degrees of freedom coming from the full theory. And in fact, this has a very important implication for the effective dynamics. In particular, if you might have heard claims in the literature that LQG predicts white hole, I would like to clarify those claims. Polymer quantization predicts white hole, maybe, but not LQG, at least not within the assumption that we have used to perform the reduction in the quantum level. If you use geometric consideration and the simplicity constraint to restrict the ambiguity given by this choice of quantum parameters, then you can predict an asymptotically the Sitter effective metric for the same value of the emissive parameter that you had from the S2 black hole entropy calculation, which is characterized by an emergent cosmological constant which has a quantum gravity origin. Now, of course, it would be very tempting to say, okay, could this explain what we see in our universe, namely, do we live inside a black hole? That's definitely too early to make such a statement. One would have to include matter in this picture and consider gravitational collapse. But a very fascinating scenario would be that actually the history of the universe that we observe is nothing else than basically the film of what happened inside the what fell inside the black hole. So the gravitational collapse of the black hole basically could describe what we see in this emerging de Sitter universe on the other side after the bounce. Of course, this is speculation, and the only evidence for this scenario is that we have this emerging de Sitter picture asymptotically. And then, of course, the other important thing would be to actually glue the inside with the outside. In order to do that, though, you have to solve the long Hamiltonian constraint I was showing you before. And in particular, you have to also, in this case, since you, if you want an horizon-penetrating foliation, you cannot set the shift to zero, so you have to include the diffeo constraint in the picture, which means that you have to look at the algebra of the constraints, of the effective constraints, which means you have to derive an effective diffeo constraint and check that it closes a modified algebra with the Hamiltonian constraint. And there are these two brave master students that volunteer to embark into this crazy calculation. And then, of course, you have to develop numerical techniques to solve, because these equations are now non-local differential equations. So it's not going to be easy to solve them even numerically. And you need to develop numerical tools to do that. And this is also some work in progress. And yeah, I think I'll finish here. Thank you very much.
One question is, the Hamiltonian constraint in the without symmetry reduction has always been a big problem. So I didn't quite catch what it seems like. You start from loop quantum gravity with a Hamiltonian constraint, and then do a symmetry reduction at the quantum level.
Yes. So what you do, yeah.
So how did you get a Hamiltonian constraint that works
that satisfy close an algebra? You mean, or what do you mean?
Well, it reproduces classical theory.
So you take Tiemann Hamiltonian. That's what we did. We take Tiemann Hamiltonian. Which is basically in the Euclidean is just this thing here. You regularize it like Tiemann does. And the simplification respect to the full theory is that the volume is diagonal now. So you can compute immediately the eigenvalue of the volume. And then you can, the rest, it's actually it's quite straightforward to compute. And you get an action of this object. Then you include the Lorentzian piece. For the Lorentzian piece, the simplification comes from the fact that you can write the Lorentzian term.
Graph-preserving
version, yes.
So there's a version which is full of anomalies, but you don't care.
Yeah.
Which is nevertheless maybe physically more useful
because
it talks to...
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I was asking if you were referring to the anomalies. We haven't checked that. I mean, probably at the quantum level, you have anomalies. This object has anomalies. That's why we want to... What we want to do when it comes to the issue of algebra is to look at the effective constraint and try to find an effective expression for the diffeo constraint, which could close an algebra with the effective Hamiltonian that we get. But this has all the issues that the graph preserving team Hamiltonian has.
You take the Hamiltonian for one.
No, at each point you compute the action for the same lapse basically everywhere, and then in the effective when you compute effective expectation value, that's where the information of the classical lapse comes in.
Yeah, but the point of the anomalies is that the Hamiltonian is not commute if you consider them different vertices, mm-hmm. and so you cannot impose them all at the same time. The Hilbert space. How do you avoid this?
Well, I mean, I don't impose it. I just compute its action.
It's the expectation.
Expectation value. I don't solve the quantum dynamics. And but what's much simpler is the Lorentzian piece, because the Lorentzian piece, if you write in terms of the curvature of the intrinsic curvature, because you can write the Lorentzian piece in terms of the extrinsic curvature or in terms of the intrinsic one, the Ricci of the trimetric, and which means that it has all the second derivatives of the fluxes, and it's a very messy expression. But now the fluxes are diagonal, so you can immediately compute that guy using discrete derivatives, and you can see that it gives you back the link order, the classical expression, plus all the corrections.
The second question, I don't want to monopolize. No, the second question, you find that you get this picture where you at the end have the late time of a De Sitter space with a cosmological constant set by the mass of the black hole. But really, which mass of the black hole is it? Because the black hole is evaporating and so...
Ah, okay, so I'm not including matter in this picture. I haven't included evaporation process in this picture. Yeah. I mean, that, of course, that could change the picture quite a bit. In fact, if this picture stays true, what can happen is basically that the Hubble parameter becomes time-dependent because the mass of the black hole is time-dependent. So you will have in fact, what will happen is that if the black hole evaporates and the mass gets smaller, then you would have a bigger Hubble parameter.
So you get back to having a single unit. It goes to infinity, yes.
Well, I mean, there is always a Planck there. I mean, if you send a Planck to zero, then yeah, you recover the classical singularity. But the thing is that, I mean, it's probably the other way around, in the sense that, yeah, the black hole might evaporate, but if this is a huge black hole, the evaporation time would be ridiculous compared to actually the inflow of matter. So I would expect actually, if you consider the collapse, to have a picture in which matter increases because of infalling matter, and that would basically correspond to a slowing down of the expansion. I mean, the mass of the black hole to recover our universe will have to be huge, way bigger than any supermassive black hole that we see in the universe.
Any more questions for anyone?
Maybe assume that you get an effective cosmological constant.
Mm-hmm.
So the semi-classical description is not valid in the interior of the black hole?
No, it is a semi-classical picture. But it has, I mean, it's a, in a way, it's a quantum universe in the sense that you...
you get something different from the Einstein equations.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the... I mean, inside, yeah, you have that, in a way, it's like when you have this, what's called Kastner isotropization,
mm-hmm.
like you have some kind of a dynamic, which is an isotropization process in the collapse. And, but yeah, the effective equations are not the classical Einstein equations after the bounds, in a way. I mean, they you recover, you know, the solutions, not the equation, the solutions are something that is different from what the classical equation motion would predict. I mean, in the classical case, you cannot continue after the singularity.
But lambda... scales
with
the Planck lengths or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank you.